Jonathan is going to talk his, oh my goodness, wrap around. This is enacting revenge, and Evgeny is going to talk about vindicating revenge.
Sorry about the cross, it's not going to be a sermon. It's going to be holding his face. I can't do that, I have to have the faith that it's done. It's going to take a while to get to kids, but when it does, I hope it's going to show why I think Spanish tragedy is so important. And I thought the program, I saw that Clara, the esteemed Spanish translator of my genius of Shakespeare book, was asking the question, how Spanish is the Spanish tragedy? So I wanted to ask the question about the other half of the title. What kind of a tragedy is the Spanish tragedy? How does Spanish tragedy fit in Elizabethan's thinking about tragedy? So this is a talk, trying to sort of imagine myself into an Elizabethan mindset of what an educated Elizabethan would have understood by that word, tragedy. The first Spanish tragedy upfront title is a tragedy. It's more or less contemporaneous, of course, with George Putnam's Art of English Poetry. In that version, the version of literary history in that book, Putnam suggests that ancient poetry began with praise of the gods, then proceeded to reprehension of human abuses. The earliest poetry of rebuke was satire, followed by comedy, and only then tragedy. For Putnam, literary genre was a sociological matter. He supposed that primitive cultures were essentially egalitarian. Early literary forms were therefore free from sharp social distinctions. Men and women of all ranks may be mocked by satire and made to look foolish by comedy. But as civilization advances, social hierarchies are established. A literary genre is then required specifically for the purpose of rebuking those who are born to or who achieve high estate, but whose behaviour is unworthy of their privileged status. The need to knock the mighty off their pedestal gives the new genre its structure. A great man, or occasionally woman, falls from high estate to low. Putnam would have read in Horace's Ars Poetica that Thespis invented tragedy, hence thespian, and that Aeschylus was the first to teach actors to talk big and wear high boots. The ultimate source for his key definition of tragedy as the fall of a person of high estate from good fortune to bad was, of course, the Poetics of Aristotle. Putnam regarded Aristotle as the prince of philosophy, but his knowledge of the work seems to have been confined to Latin translations of the Politics and the Ethics. For most Elizabethans, Aristotle was a master of political theory and moral philosophy. He was not primarily a literary critic. So the Elizabethan version of the Poetics was an indirect one. The classical dramatist most frequently studied at school and university in Elizabethan England was Terence. Most editions of his comedy included not only a prose account of his life, but also an essay ascribed to the 4th century commentator Aelius Donatus, concerning tragedy and comedy. Here we find a rigid division of genres. Comedies are concerned with private citizens of low-life characters, tragedies with monarchs, rulers, and heroes. Comedies end in reversal for the better, recognition of children, happy marriage. Tragedies in reversal for the worse, a mighty fall, a mournful death. As Thomas Heywood put it a few years later in his Apology for Actors, comedies begin in trouble and end in peace. Tragedies begin in calm and end in tempest. That's amazing how the tempest, in contrast, begins in tempest and ends in calm. Of course, this conception of tragedy was consistent with that of the Middle Ages. The absence of secular drama in Chaucer's England did not mean there was no interest in tragedy, because tragedy may be thought of as a narrative structure as well as a dramatic event. You remember the famous definition in the prologue to the Monk's Tale, tragedy is to say a certain story, as only books make in us memory, of him that stood in great prosperity and is fallen out of high degree into misery and ended wretchedly. And of course, Boccaccio is hugely influential. De Casibus Virorum Illustrium was a series of tales of the fallen illustrious men. Both the title of the collection and the structure of each story were synonymous with tragedy. The De Casibus tradition, we call it, don't we? Fortune turns the wheel, a great man tumbles from the power, it reached the end of the beaten by Lydgate's Fall of Princes, kind of free translation of Boccaccio, one of the earliest English printed books. And of course, after the Elizabethans, the great source of that was the Mirror for Magistrates, that unreasonable, highly influential collection of narratives of illustrious men, mostly from English history, who tell the stories of their own downfall. Remember Saxon's induction. Lo here, quod sorrow, princes of renown that whilom sat on top of fortune's wheel, now laid low, like wretches whirled down, even with one frown that stayed but with a smile. And now behold the things that thou erewhile saw only in thought, and what thou now shalt hear, recount the same to Caesar, king, and peer. The Puttenham's view, contemporaneous with Spanish tragedy, of tragedy as an admonitory mirror for princes and courtiers, is squarely in this tradition. And those distinctions, traceable to Donatus, are to be found everywhere in Elizabethan discussions of tragedy. The argument of tragedy, wrote Stephen Gosling in his plays Confuted and Five Actions, is wrath, cruelty, incest, injury, murder, either violent by sword or voluntary by poison. The friends, gods, goddesses, juries, friends, kings, queens, and mighty men. By contrast, the groundwork of comedy is love, covenage, flattery, bawdry, sly conveyance of whoredom, the persons, cooks, knaves, boors, parasites, courtesans, lecherous old men, amorous young men. Gosling was poacher turned gamekeeper, a sometime playwright who, sensing a chill wind blowing against the theatre, joined the Puritan attack on the stage. His enumeration of the typical content of tragedy and comedy is skewed in support of the argument that the Elizabethan playhouse was a school of abuse, a resort for wasters, troublemakers, pickpockets, whores, and adulterers. Gosling and his fellow polemicists were richly down Platonists, crude recyclers of the ancient argument that plays are dangerous to the body politic because by representing violence and transgression they destabilise propriety and stir up unhealthy emotion. The explicit objection is that if commoners go to the playhouse and see stage persons breaking the moral law or, like Hieronymo, taking justice into their own hands, they might be encouraged to do the same themselves. The implicit fear is that dramatic representation of the heinous deeds of divinities, monarchs, governors, and legal officials, Gosling's jury, will diminish the authority of the real-life equivalent of such figures. If the king in the play marries his elder brother's widow, and the avenging hero calls the union incestuous, what is to prevent such a judgment from leading to an awkward line of inquiry regarding not-so-distant history? Henry VIII married his elder brother's widow, Catherine of Aragon, so was the founder of the Church of England, therefore an incestuous adulterate beast. It was in defence of the theatre, and in response to Plato's argument in the Republic that plays were dangerous and the state would be better off without them, that Aristotle wrote his Poetics. The defence was in effect medicinal. By stirring up strong emotions in the controlled space of the theatre, the drama purges us of extremities and imbalances. Theatre does serve society, providing containment rather than provocation. Thus, Aristotle. So since Sidney's apology for poetry was to Puritan anti-stage polemic as Aristotle's Poetics was to Platonic anti-theatrical prejudice. Sidney's retort to Gosling is that the properly structured tragedy, far from advocating wrath, cruelty, incest, injury, and murder, will deliver a dire warning against the consequences of crime. And I think that delivery of warning is very much what we get in those moments when the moral voice returns at the end of the justice. So to Sidney, the key point is that the revenger gets his comeuppance, the usurper gets his just deserts. Tragedy is a school not of abuse, but of virtue. Where the moral philosopher will tell you about virtue, vice, and passion in the abstract by means of arid classification, the tragic dramatist will show you them in action, so that we seem not to hear of them, but clearly to see through them. The drama for Sidney is an incomparable source of insight about human behaviour. So a bit of Sidney. Anger, the Stoics say, was a short madness. let but Sophocles bring you Ajax on stage, killing and whipping sheep and oxen, thinking that the army are Greeks with their chieftains Agamemnon and Menelaus, and tell me if you have not a more familiar insight into anger than finding in the schoolmen his genus and difference. See where the wisdom and temperance of Ulysses and Diomedes, valour in Achilles, friendship in Nisus and Euryalus, even to an ignorant man, carry not an apparent shining. And contrarily, the remorse of conscience of Oedipus, the soon repenting pride of Agamemnon, the self-devouring cruelty of his father Atreus, the violence of ambition of the two Theban brothers, the sour sweetness of revenge in Medea. Here, Sidney has intuited the integral relationship between virtue, vice, and passion on the one hand, and dramatic structure on the other. The height of the hero's vertiginous fall is measured by the wise and good man's steadfast walk along the flat, straight road. The weft of tragedy is Aristotle's change from high estate to low. Conscience catches up with Faustus. Queen Tamora's cruelty in Titus proves self-devouring, literally. Revenge for Hieronymo is sour sweet. The walk is the constancy of the friend who remains loyal to the fallen hero, or the wise and temperate counsellor who sticks to his course even as his advice is neglected. Marcus Andronicus, say, or Horatio in Hamlet are embodiments of friendship and temperance wrapped together. For Sidney, the dramatist is superior to the philosopher because a story seized is more memorable than a moral told. And the theatre is superior to the history book because the dramatist can impose order on the chaos of events. Whilst the historian is captive to the truth of a foolish world in which the wicked often thrive and the virtuous suffer, the dramatist can show virtue exalted and vice punished. In real life, a tyrant may rule for years, but if evil men come to the stage, they never go out so manacled as they little animate folk to follow them. I think Sidney's thinking there of a famous defence of the tragedian's art, which is reported in one of Plutarch's moral essays. Euripides is said to have answered critics who attacked his Ixion as impious and vile by saying, "But I didn't take him off the stage until he was nailed to the wheel." So much Christopher Marlowe has defended his representation of Tamburlaine the Great, Dr. Faustus, and Barabbas, the rich Jew and mortal, all of whom end with a mighty fall. Yet with Marlowe, as indeed with Euripides, one suspects that the defence has been tongue-in-cheek. Sickness falls on Tamburlaine not when he commits one of his many un-Christian acts, such as ordering the slaying of the virgins of Damascus, but when he burns the book, which men like Sidney would have regarded as the archetypal heterodox pagan text, the Quran. The extolling of virtue and the punishment of vice provided neither the box office spice nor the intellectual challenge for the tragedians of the late 1580s and early 1590s. The typical English play of the earlier 16th century had been the interlude in which an everyman figure, an embodiment of youth or worldly man, would be tempted by a series of alluring emissaries of worldliness, a bearer of the gold of wealth and power, a portly glutton, a seductress oozing lechery, before being rescued from the clutches of these vices by a pious, reasonable voice of conscience or wise counsel. The Elizabethan dramatists celebrated what the Puritan polemicists feared, that what is most memorable about these old plays is not the structure of redemption, but the energy of the vice. The audience cannot help but be disappointed at the moment when the vice is driven out of the play, not least because it exited the signs of the end of the entertainment. As so often, one of the keys to late Elizabethan creative genius is its combination of native and classical inheritances. And Philip talked a bit about this, about how he both puts Christian and classical structure at work. That kind of hybridization is actually apparent as early as 1567, when John Pickering's Orestes brings the vice and counsel together with Clytemnestra and Orestes, and for good measure he throws in some very English clowns, Hodge and Rusticus. And of course, by the time we reach Marlowe and Shakespeare, the main character himself may be a historicized and individualized version of the vice singer, Baradasse or Richard III. pervasive self-conscious play acting is thus grafted onto the ancient art of making theatre out of the peripeteia, the reversal of fortune, and the anagnorisis, the self-recognition of some hero from the history. It's an interesting question as to how the figure of Lorenzo might be related to that vice tradition. The problem with pedants and polemicists is that they like neat packages. Donatus parcels comedy and tragedy into different boxes. The Puritan pamphleteers regard dramatic characters as dangerous images of vice, so Sidney has to respond with an equally crude notion of heroic virtue. The dramatist knows, to the contrary, that in real life, good and bad are not to be found apart. There is a sort of mixture. The fragment of Euripides quoted in Plutarch's Tale of the Ending of Prometheus. Or Shakespeare puts it, the web of our life is of a mingled yarn, good and ill together. So reading the tragedies that follow from Donatus are simplification of Aristotle's original treatment of the tragic form. You remember Aristotle in the Poetics said, you don't want to show the leading character being either perfectly good or perfectly bad. It's got to be one who is not preeminent in moral virtue, who passes to bad fortune, not through vice or wickedness, but because of some piece of ignorance, hamartia, and who is a time to good fortune. So for Aristotle, the cause of the tragic fall is very specifically not vice or wickedness. Aeneas is tragic not because of some moral failing, but because he kills his father and marries his mother in ignorance of their identity. Theories of tragedy like Putnam embrace the Aristotelian structure, the mutability of fortune, but justify it in the very terms that Aristotle said were not tragic, wickedness reproach, the just punishment of God and revenge for vicious and evil life. Just as 16th century tragic theory is frequently based on a moralistic misreading of Aristotle, so many 20th century readings of Aristotle's tragedy were based on a psychological misreading of Aristotle. Granted, Aristotle's theory was more psychological than moral, a principal emphasis in the Poetics, but indeed the theatre audience's emotional response to tragedy. The play evokes strong feeling, pity, fear, wonder, in such a way that the intensification of emotion allows a release, catharsis from it. But the interest here is the psychology of the audience. Aristotle does not explain the downfall of tragic theory in psychological terms. Disaster follows from a mistaken action, a deed committed in ignorance of the fact that its consequences will be terrible. It does not follow from an inherent psychological flaw in the hero's nature. For Aristotle, action determines character, not vice versa. He recognises that drama is gripping when apparently small actions have large consequences. Nothing is more dramatic than a chain reaction. In Shakespeare's Titus, the Romans perform their customary expiation of the spirits of those who died in battle by sacrificing the highest born male among their prisoners of war. Titus overrules Greece for moral supplication of her son's life. His ignorance of her cunning and her single-minded determination to revenge costs his own daughter her chastity, two of her sons her head, and ultimately her head, and ultimately several others, including himself, and life. There is no warrant in either Aristotle or Elizabethan theory for the idea of the tragic flaw. Aristotle's hamartia is an action, not a predisposition. Shakespeare's Romeo and Kyd's Hieronymo were two of the most highly praised creations of Elizabethan tragedy, yet neither has an obvious flaw. How can it be a flaw in Romeo's nature for him to love Juliet, or for Hieronymo to take it upon himself to hunt down his son's murderers, once recourse to the proper authority has failed? The tragedy of Romeo and Juliet is triggered not by a moral failing or a psychological predisposition, but by a tiny misadventure, a letter that does not get delivered. The term tragedy, as a generic description, entered English usage with the Elizabethan translation of Seneca, the Roman dramatist, and Philip talked a little bit about this. When the word was first used in the first translation in the 1560s, I think readers wouldn't have been quite clear what was meant by tragedy. But by the end of the century, Seneca, in Polonius' disquisition on the dramatic genre, has become synonymous with a heavy play. So what is Phoenician tragedy like? It's structured in five acts, divided by a chorus. The action is a reaction to a terrible event that's taken place in the past, of which we may be reminded by the ghost. The central character cannot easily be labelled either a hero or a villain. He or she is called to revenge, but the drama takes place in his head, not on the stage. We hear a lot about blood and cruelty and sensational violence, but always second hand. This is a drama to be read or heard more than seen. The principal interest is verbal, the rhetoric, the verbal figures, the sententiae, the set piece descriptions of the nuntia. The play consists of a series of monologues of self-definition, in which the problem of evil is inextricable from the problem of knowledge. Once self-discovery is achieved, death is the only cause. Seneca's philosophical essays are meditations on the art of quelling the passions through the power of reason. His tragedies show what happens when passion runs out of control. And you can see in all that the deep influence of Seneca on Kyd, but then also the fact that the same, the terrible actions are off stage in Seneca, Kyd, so many of them are on stage. The preface to the Elizabethan translation of Seneca, Thomas Newton weighed Seneca's philosophizing against passion. He says, gravity of philosophical sentences, weightiness of sappy words, authority of sound matter, beat down thin, loose life, dissolute feeling, and unbridled sensuality. But that is a response to tragedy read, not tragedy seen. In the preface to Green's Menaphon, Tom Nash noted that English Seneca read by candlelight yields many good sentences, whole hamlets, I should say, handfuls of tragical speeches. But he went on to suggest that having bled Seneca dry for his language, playwrights working for the popular stage would need to look elsewhere to lurid Italian novellas, for instance, for their dramatic action. So Seneca provided the professional dramatist with structures and sententiae. Kyd's Spanish tragedy begins with a ghost and a personification of revenge, just as Thyestes begins with a ghost and a fury advocating revenge. Shakespeare quotes the famous appeal to the gods from the Hippolytus in Titus in the original Latin. Tam lentus audi scelera, tam lentus vide. Are you so slow to hear crime, so slow to see? The rhetoric of self-examination in the Elizabethan tragic soliloquy is learnt in part from Seneca's Man, but only in part, for its flexibility, I always think, has more in common with the epistolary self-expression of Ovidian woman, the heroine. At its core, popular tragedy was not Seneca. How could it be when what was required for popularity was not philosophizing, but action replete with spectacle and leavened by comedy? And that, of course, is why for Sidney, there was neither decency nor discretion, neither the admiration and commiseration proper to tragedy, nor the right thoughtfulness proper to comedy in the, let's phrase, mongrel tragicomedy of the contemporary drama. English Seneca tragedy was written by elite amateur authors for elite courtly or academic audiences. Would be read in a closet or heard in a hall, as one would hear a lecture or attend a debate, and above all concerned with wise policy. Greville would have to be the greatest example of that kind of writing. One might call this elite Elizabethan Seneca. It was in the tradition of advice to the prince, Atkins Act, the American magistrates as well. So it was that Sackville proceeded from his involvement with Gorboduc, from presenting the first English tragedy, to his contribution of the induction of Paul Buckingham to the American magistrate. In the public drama of the 1590s, tragedy seems to be located, as it is in Seneca, in the interim. But both the sowing of the seed and the reaping of the whirlwind are seen before our eyes, in the way they are not in the Seneca tradition. The choices facing the protagonist are explored more inwardly to the delivery. So the psychological dimension of the political becomes as important as the political itself. Consider Brutus's version of the interim, between the acting of a dreadful thing and the first motion, all the interims is like a phantasma or a hideous dream. The genius and the mortal instrument are there in council, and the state of man, like to a little kingdom, suffers very much the nature of a beastly erection. Julius Caesar is a dramatization of the most famous political assassination in history. Yet at this moment, insurrection is merely a metaphor for the mental turbulence of the individual on a sleepless night before a momentous day. Gorilla, the one major tragedy of Scipio's Mars, produced a skeleton play with one unfeminine element, and that element was the play's use of dumb show. But it seems to me that the professional dramatists of the next generation, the late 18th and 19th, capitalised on the potential for audience-pleasing spectacle that was provided by tableaux, such as those between the acts in Gorsica. Peel Battle Alcazar is a revenge drama in which the action is driven by possibly the first of the Machiavellian laws of the English drama. But it's also a play which incorporates dumb shows, three ghosts crying, "We need our revenge." Got a bloody banquet, got a blazing star. These dumb shows obviously became highly popular, but rather quickly became an old-fashioned device. So there was a challenge to do something new with the device. Marlowe and Shakespeare had the answer to that, to incorporate it in the action of the play itself, rather than Tamburlaine. The Spanish tragedy, so therefore seems to me to set the pattern for late Elizabethan revenge drama, by raising theatrical self-consciousness to a new level of sophistication. King was the first to deploy the device of the frame, an induction, a chorus, a series of prologues surrounding the action, to its full potential of multivalency and irony. Geronimo's Mask of English Conquest is the first surviving instance of a character playing the role of the master of rebels. Here I think there is a genuine connection with what Philip has said. Philip argued that the sense that Shakespeare comes to sort of replace a supernatural structure with a self-consciously dramatic structure where a character from within the play, whether it be Edgar, whether it be Hamlet, Prospero working through Ariel, or for that matter Peter Quinn, becomes a dramatist figure. Hieronymo does exactly that. He becomes the master of the rebels. His play, in Sundry Language, is a seminal, deeply influential example of the idea that the revenge is performed through performance at the end of the play. And of course, Women Beware Women is the sort of great later example that takes that forward. It's brilliantly done in the Newton Barrett production, that sense of the play within the play being the thing that resolves the revenge, in of course a way that works rather differently from Hamlet. And more broadly than that, the whole of the Spanish tragedy is seized with an interest in the resources and semiotic potentialities of theatre. Think, for instance, of that profusion of wittily deployed props: box, dagger, rope, book, napkin, pen. We think in the minimalism of the Elizabethan theatre, props are so important to the fact because you don't have that many of them. Well, that frame device, we are to imagine the whole action of the performance, summoned by revenge, the edification of the ghost of Don Andrea, is not without precedent. You can find one or two earlier examples. But it's without precedent in its sophistication in linking in to the way in which a debate about revenge becomes dramatised within the action. So the audience goes to the theatre having been taught by church and law that revenge is wrong, and yet the first encounter they witness in the play is one in which not merely the ethos but the person of revenge is in charge. By the end of the play, revenge now performs, the two members of the on-stage or above-stage audience are well satisfied. I say on stage or above stage because there's that debate about are they sitting there in the above space or are they maybe in the floor to the left side or are they physically on the stage itself? From his debate with himself in at the end of the third act, book in hand, asking to revenge or not to revenge, that's the question, to his final acts, which are foreclosures of communication and revelation, tongue bitten out, pen knife used to bring death, not to facilitate writing. The point of a pen knife is that it's a knife to sharpen the pen, but not here. In all those things, Hirono is a figure who constantly presents the audience with questions, not answers. And indeed, even after the full details of his plot have been explained, he insists that something is being held back, but never shalt thou force me to reveal the thing which I have vowed inviolate. Abiliago, demand me nothing, what you know, from this time forth I never will speak word. There is an uncomfortable sense that the end has not revealed all. It's a very different world, this, from the very strong sense of divine requital, which Hutton and Sidney, theoretical versions of tragedy, tend to emphasize. Andrea is confident that Hieronymo lost the Olivian fields, but the offstage audience may not be so sure. One may very well imagine his arrival in Avernus being greeted by precisely the kind of disputation about his disposal between the three judges of the underworld as that concerning Don Andrea with which the play began. The frame therefore sets up a value structure that is complicated and questioned by the protagonist's anguished quest for justice in the main action. When in one of those stages, the tragedy of Solomon and Cassina, which of course you remember was expanded into a full-length tragedy in its own right, sometimes attributed to Kidd himself, he uses this extraordinary device of having it performed with one character speaking in Latin, another in Greek, third in Italian, and a fourth in French. He deliberately rejects the languages of both his on-stage audience, who are Spanish and Portuguese, and his off-stage one, who are English. By writing in a language that neither audience understands, Kidd makes room for complete concentration on the action. And that concentration is needed because of the dazzling complexity of layers of illusion. In Playing the Murderer, Hieronymo actually commits the murder. Stage Daggers actually take the lives of Lorenzo Baltazar's death. But the moment one says this, one recognises that that is how it looks to the on-stage audience, whereas the off-stage audience, known perfectly well as Hieronymo or Ed Allen or whoever is taking the lead, is only playing the murderer. And again, since the off-stage audience is in a similar position to the on-stage audience insofar as they are baffled by the play of sundry languages, perhaps the knowledge that it is only a play has become an imperfect knowledge. As with Hermione's statue in The Winter's Tale, but far more troublingly, the interplay of art and life, art and nature, has become blurred. That blurring is all important because it forces the critical gaze from art to life. Hieronymo's playing, central to which is his assumption of the role of madman, beginning with Sidney Ford, Hamlet, and Edgar, the students of the has created a kind of total theatre in which every object, word, and action becomes potentially illusory. So again, we're going further and further from this very kind of stable notion of tragedy in relation to justice, which goes back to Donatus, to Seneca. See here my show, look on this spectacle, he says, anticipating W.B. Yeats' mirror on mirror, mirrored in all the show. Attention is drawn to the tools of the poetic dramatist's craft, tongue, pen, penknife, but then they are instantly transformed from instruments for the creation of art to instruments for the destruction of life. Earlier, proleptically, there had been a tearing of paper, the artist's other instrument. Deconstruction is really But the papers in question have been not plays, but legal documents presented to Hieronymo in his capacity as knight marshal, a declaration of debt, an action of the case requiring a writ, and an ejectione firmae via lease. In Kidd's total theatre, the law becomes a text, something invulnerable of an author's foul papers. As the artist is deconstructed by his own instruments, so the law is deconstructed by being reduced to a series of props that are displayed and then evacuated of meaningful content. And again, I think this is very proto-Shakespearean. I think about the way in which Shakespeare uses theatre to critique the symbols of authority. For instance, in the great Henry IV, Part 1, pre-enactment of Hal's return to the court, where Paul Sussex writes, you know, this chair will be my throne, this cushion will be my crown. By using those props, he shows that the symbols of authority, crown, the throne, are merely props. They don't actually have inherent authority. So, at one moment in the Spanish tragedy, there is an on-stage execution. But at another, the law's final instrument, the hangman's rope, appears not on the gallows, but in Hieronymus' hand, from which it is then flung away. As the law's most merciful instrument, the pardon, it is apparently kept ceremonially in a box. The box is never opened, and despite, we know it is empty. Hieronymus, the man of law, he has a legal position at the start of what he thinks, fulfills his role as bringer of justice, not in legislation or litigation, but when he knocks up the curtain. The public drama progressed by means of bold experimentation, self-conscious playing of this kind, which swerves the ancient tradition of tragedy in a wholly new direction. It is, I suggest, because of their dazzling theatricality, a theatricality for which the Spanish tragedy was the first great example. Because of that dazzling theatricality, the tragedies of Cid, Marlowe, Shakespeare, Masters, and Middleton have remained alive in later centuries. Seneca drama, on the other hand, has died with the death of the capital.